Good afternoon, and thank you for joining us today. I'm Bill Hoagland, Senior Vice President here at the Bipartisan Policy Center. For those of you who are unfamiliar with the Bipartisan Policy Center, we were established about 15 years ago by four former majority leaders of the United States Senate, Senator Bob Dole and the late Senator Howard Baker on the Republican side, Senator George Mitchell and Senator Tom Daschle on the Democratic side. As the name would imply, we try as best we can to bring the best ideas of both parties together to promote health and security and opportunity for all Americans. I want to thank Yahoo Finance for their partnership in bringing this program to us today. With the recent passage of the Bipartisan Infrastructure Framework, which, as I understand, the president will be signing here within the hour, and with the prospect of the president's Build Back Better agenda maybe becoming law, legislative action could be poised to dramatically impact American households and businesses in the coming months. And meanwhile, as we all know from headlines last week, rising inflation, global supply chain shortages, labor mismatches continue to challenge this economic recovery. In a moment, we will be joined by Rick Newman, Yahoo Finance's senior columnist, and Phil Swagel, the current director of the Congressional Budget Office, or CBO. They're going to help break down what all this might mean for American families. As many of you know, CBO is the official scorekeeper for Congress, and it is receiving, of course, a lot of attention this week as it develops its final estimates on the House's Build Back Better agenda legislation. And the person in the hot seat is Phil, who manages the nonpartisan 275-person staff preparing the objective impartial estimates surrounding this nearly 2,100-page bill. Phil is the 10th CBO director in its 47-year history, having been appointed by the House Speaker and President Pro Tem back in 2019. Phil previously served as the Assistant Secretary of the Treasury for Economic Policy in the George W. Bush administration, and important to us here at BPC, he co-chaired our financial regulatory reform initiatives in 2012. He's a trained economist with degrees from Princeton and Harvard. It is indeed my honor, particularly since I'm an alumni of that organization at CBO, and I want to welcome Dr. Swagel to Yahoo Finance. So, Rick, over to you.
Swagel, for joining us. So there's some news just now about when we're going to see the complete analysis or the so-called score of the Build Back Better legislation. Why don't you tell us what you can about when that's coming?
Sure thing. Yeah, thanks, Rick. It's a pleasure to be here. And thanks to Bill Hoagland and BPC for having me on. So CBO just posted on our blog a note providing more information on the timing of our complete cost estimate for the Build Back Better Act. We've been putting out titles as we finish them rather than waiting until we have the entire bills estimated. And so we've put out a number of them already. We'll have two more today. And then we're now sure that we'll have the entire bill, all the titles, done by the end of Friday. If we can get it done before then, of course we will, but certainly by the end of Friday, we'll have the entire estimate.
Just so the audience is aware, the timing matters a lot here because Congress is not going to take any action on this, and it would happen first in the House until the CBO score is public. Since timing is so tight on this, can you say any chance whether it will be in the morning on Friday, the, you know, 11:59 p.m. on Friday?
I honestly don't know. I think everyone understands we want this as soon as we can. We're not trying to, get something in at the end of Friday. It's a big bill. It's a complicated bill. There's big pieces that have interactions. Those are the titles that we're still working on that will come at the end. Some of the complications are those interactions that, changes in the provisions such as the subsidies for the Affordable Care Act interact with other provisions, the judiciary title, for example. And so those are the sorts of things that just take more time to analyze.
Right. So the essential question here is whether this bill will pay for itself. Is there anything you can tell us about whether it will or won't?
So that I can't yet, that essentially will come as people look at the entire estimate. And, you know, we don't have it yet. So I couldn't even say, you know, we've been doing it a title at a time. I was about to say a little at a time, but the titles are not little. So that's the wrong word, but it's a title at a time. And then people can look at the title and evaluate the pieces. But I understand there's a lot of interest in the entire estimate, and people will have to just, you know, I have to apologize. People will just have to wait because, you know, we're working as fast as we can, knowing the timeline that the Congress is working on.
So, Phil, I want to ask you about one provision where the CBO has published some analysis. It's this question of better IRS enforcement of people mm-hmm. who are evading taxes or not paying taxes for whatever reason. So the Biden administration, of course, wants $80 billion from Congress over a decade to beef up the IRS. And they say that on net, after you account for the $80 billion, that will bring in about $400 billion of revenue, and CBO has a much lower estimate of the net revenue gain from that. I think it's $125 billion. That's a big disparity. So why the difference there?
Okay, so I can talk about what we've done is we have analyzed the proposal in the legislation and from the administration before that to provide more resources to the IRS. And this is a topic in which CBO staff and Treasury staff have done a lot of work, and there's people at CBO have been at Treasury and vice versa. So it's something that we're very familiar with and have a pretty well-established methodology. Now, in the current proposal, we've also worked hard to understand where the money would go. And you can imagine providing more resources to the IRS, the service could put more money into customer service, that when people call, their questions will be answered, and better training for the people answering the phone calls, or they could go more to the audit staff, more to technology. So there's lots of different uses for the resources. We have talked to the people on the other side of this at the service at the Treasury to develop an understanding of the uses that they would put those resources to. Now, of course, right, this is you know, ultimately, it's up to the executive branch to decide on the resources, but that informs our estimate. And one other key aspect of our estimate is the idea of deterrence. And, you know, my understanding is that there's other analyses that put a lot of weight on the idea of deterrence, that if people know that, you know, the IRS is doing more and auditing more, that, you know, that essentially, you know, other people then pay more of their taxes. The research literature on this is very mixed. You know, for high net worth individuals, for large companies, right? Tax bills, and so the tax filings are complicated, and there's an element of negotiation to those filings. And the research literature suggests that when a company understands that other companies similarly situated are being audited or examined, that sometimes they actually take a more aggressive position at the start of this bargain. And again, you can understand why, if ultimately this is a negotiation with the IRS, then you know they might start in a different place. And so the research literature on deterrence is, I'd say, very mixed. And so we end up, as we've described in a previous blog post, coming down in the middle of that literature on the effects of deterrence on additional revenues. My understanding is that others take more either optimistic or aggressive positions and really see a lot of weight on deterrence, you know, which again is within the possibilities, that's for sure. It's just not as we see it in the center of the research literature.
So if I'm getting that right, you're saying that more aggressive enforcement of tax evasion and tax avoidance would lead to more aggressive tax evasion and tax avoidance?
No, I guess that is a shorthand. It's certainly going to have an effect. And so we definitely see an impact. And as you said, we see about north of $200 billion gross, which nets out to, you know, north of $120 billion dollars from this. So it's not that, you know, you put more money into the service, you actually lose money. It's not that at all, but it does affect the behavior of people on the other end of the IRS.
Well, based on your first part of the answer to that question, does that suggest that your understanding of the way the IRS would deploy that money? Because everybody's analyzing the same $80 billion over a decade. Mm-hmm. Are you suggesting there could be a more effective or more efficient way to spend that $80 billion than your understanding of the way the IRS wants to do it?
Oh, I see. No, I don't mean to imply that at all. And so, you know, one aspect of CBO that's important is that we provide analysis, but not our opinion. And so CBO has no normative view on what the best way to deploy these resources is. And, you know, the IRS certainly has the best, is in the best position to understand its own needs. And so we try to understand what they will do, but there's no implication that they're doing the right thing or the wrong thing, or the resources could be used better.
So let's say it is $80 billion in spending produces $120 to $125 in net return. Is that a good return, you know, in the universe of things the government could spend money on?
Again, this is from the CBO position, we just wouldn't comment on what the right use of government resources is. We will provide Congress with the analysis it needs to make those decisions, but ultimately that's up to policymakers. And so this is, again, my view is that the Congress will get our analysis and not our opinion.
So let's talk about inflation a little bit. 6.2% was the latest annual inflation number. That's the highest in 31 years. CBO does do macroeconomic forecasting. Where do you see inflation landing in 2022 and 2023?
We are at the beginning of our cycle of updating our macro projections. And this is the first step as we do an update of the budget that we will release early in 2022, whether in January or the first half of February. And we're looking ahead based on current law. So current law, as of now, includes the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, the so-called BIF. And then it could be that current law will, by the time we publish, will also include the Build Back Better Act. So we have to think about both of these. What's the effect? What's going on with inflation, you know, now? And then what happens if there's additional legislation? Inflation is clearly elevated, as you said. The last monthly data indicated that very clearly. And as many people have observed, there's a confluence of factors. It's not just one thing. There's not one lever to flip to reduce inflation, and certainly not to reduce it quickly. It's a mix of very strong demand, and then a whole host of challenges on the supply side, from labor markets, transportation, particular product markets, trade barriers, and other things. And so we're trying to figure that out. We know inflation will remain elevated. I think that's kind of the consensus. That inflation will remain elevated at least through the first half of next year, and more likely throughout a large part of next year. We're trying to figure out exactly how that goes, because it feeds into the budget, and that's ultimately what we need to know.
Right. So there's this, you're aware of this, this debate, I'm sure. Is it temporary or transient or mm-hmm. transitory, or is it something you might call permanent? That's oversimplified, but the idea is, the question is, will inflation basically dissipate into 22 and 23, or is it going to stay about where it is for some worrisome period of time? Can you just, as an economist, do you have a view on that?
From the CBO perspective, we have to project inflation because that feeds into the into the budget. And so I do have to have a view about how long the elevated inflation will persist. And that's what we're trying to figure out. It's going to persist into next year. And I think we can be pretty confident of that, given the labor market dynamics, and given what's happening at the ports, and given what's happening in other aspects of the supply side of the U.S. economy. Beyond that, it's just difficult to say, right? I think we understand that as the virus recedes, that will help with the labor force. As the situation in schools continues to normalize, that will also help with the supply of labor. You know, what's going on in the ports and other aspects of the supply chain is just hard to say. We're trying to figure it out, as we provide our budget update.
So three big pieces of legislation this year. There was the American Rescue Plan, which Congress passed in March, the infrastructure plan, which Congress just passed, and then the Build Back Better legislation, which Congress is still trying to pass. So if you go back to that first big bill, it's now, that stimulus money's been flowing into the economy. Does CBO make any connection between the American Rescue Plan and elevated inflation?
Well, certainly there is a connection. We have not done the analysis yet, so I can't tell you, X point Y percentage points. What is that connection? But we will do that analysis certainly over time. The provisions, as you said, of the American Rescue Plan Act provided a wide range of resources throughout the economy to families, to schools, to many others. We've seen very strong demand. And against the supply constraints, that strong demand has led to higher inflation. So it's not just the ARPA, the American Rescue Plan Act. It's the mix of what's been happening on the demand side of the economy and what's happening on the supply side of the economy that's resulting in elevated inflation.
So the infrastructure bill that Congress just passed, what is CBO's outlook for the effect that is likely to have on the overall economy, both in terms of any impact or connection with inflation and then economic growth? Is that going to be a big boost to growth?
Okay. So, again, we're still analyzing that now. We do have a cost estimate of the IIJA, the Bipartisan Infrastructure Framework, that shows the sequence of the spending over time. And one aspect of infrastructure investment is that it does take time for those dollars to flow into the economy. So there will be some impact in the near term, and that will contribute to elevated demand. On the other hand, many of the dollars will flow out over time. And I think we're all familiar now that it takes time to build roads, to build bridges. It takes time to improve rural broadband, to replace lead pipes, and so on. And so the effects of that bill will tend to play out over time. And as you say, importantly, infrastructure investment will also have positive effects on productivity. And we haven't analyzed the specific aspects of the bill, but from our past work on other aspects of infrastructure, of traditional, of physical infrastructure, we know that there is a positive effect of infrastructure investment on productivity and therefore on GDP, and that in turn will mean a better supply side. So the increased demand will certainly come, but at the same time, over time, we will have a better supply side of the economy as well.
We've had a ton of deficit spending in 2020 and 2021. So we're going to have a deficit in fiscal year 21 of around $2.8 trillion, I believe is the CBO number. And we've got a national debt of $29 trillion. The bond vigilantes years ago said we were going to have economic disaster if we ever got to this point. We have not had an economic disaster. When will this heavy debt load start to matter?
The debt load matters today, and it matters in several ways. So one is just net interest payments. Now, the part of government outlays that are devoted just paying the interest on the treasury securities, on the debt. Now, low interest rates mean that flow of payments is lower than it would have been otherwise. And so that's, that certainly reduces the pressure coming from deficits. On the other hand, the large debt stock means that the fiscal position is more at risk. So if interest rates were to rise, and we've seen some rise already over the last couple of months, but if interest rates were to rise further, the larger debt stock means that the US is more vulnerable to higher payments resulting from that. So it's not so much, there's an immediate crisis, but there's a growing vulnerability. And in my mind, that's the key risk with the rising debt profile.
Phil Swindle, there's a lot more we could ask you about, but we know you have to get back to that important work of scoring the Build Back Better legislation. Phil Swindle, Director of the Congressional Budget Office, thank you for joining us today.
Rick, thanks so much. It's a pleasure.
We're going to discuss some of this now with two economists, Diane Swonk, who is Chief Economist at consulting firm Grant Thornton, and with Joe Minarak, a senior vice president at the Conference Board and a former chief economist at the Office of Management and Budget. Diane, what did you make of what Phil had to say?
Yeah, I thought it was really important that he noted that it's all of the above, that it's affecting inflation right now, but also that last comment on debt service burden. Interest rates are extremely low right now. When we talk about infrastructure investment, my preference would be to go ahead and take advantage of ultra low interest rates and issue much longer term debt to finance infrastructure investment. But when it comes to the other part of the plan, the Build Back Better plan, although I wish some of the infrastructure in that plan was in the infrastructure bill, but that said, that I don't get to choose that, Congress does, I think we need to have more of that financed and paid for at this particular time, given the upward pressure on inflation. And I think this is a period in time that's we have no roadmap for. I agree with Phil that we're going to see inflation at an elevated pace, not at the pace that we're going to see through the first 6 months of the year in the second half, but it will still be elevated. And I think the risk of the Fed reacting to that and perhaps overreacting, I think they need to react. The question is, do they panic or are they patient as they deal with this? And that's a fine line between the two. And I'm not sure I know what the right answer is because there's no precedence for where we're at. You could get a much higher interest rate scenario that make all of a sudden what Phil was talking about in terms of vulnerabilities of our debt and large outstanding debt and the debt service burden be much larger. And even though I'm very optimistic about, you know, the productivity we get from things like infrastructure and the need for many of the programs we're talking about in order to bring people back into the labor force in the Build Back Better plan, I think those are very important. That said, those are more transfers to individuals and tend to be more inflationary in the near term. And that side of it, I think, needs to be paid for.
You know, when we're talking about inflation, this term temporary or transitory, nobody's ever defined what that means. So the date that I have in mind that by which we need to know whether this is temporary or permanent is the midterm elections in 2022 and probably a month, two or three before then when some voters are going to be making up their minds. So Joe Minerak, Phil Swagel said he sees elevated inflation into 2022, more or less. You agree with that? Joe, I think you're muted. Happens to the best of us.
I think I was muted by management. Okay.
I didn't do it.
That having been said, I think Diane drew an important distinction, which is, what is the Federal Reserve going to make of this circumstance and how are they going to react? But if you look at where this inflation came from, in the last couple months, we've been saying that it has become relatively broad-based. But if you look where it started, it occurred in specific markets like automobiles, which had the problem of the shortage of computer chips, which the manufacture of which was disrupted to some extent by the pandemic. It occurred in goods that were being shipped through our supply chain, as another example. If the Federal Reserve were to try to slam on the brakes to reduce demand generally because of inflation that is arising because of sectoral problems, conceivably it could slow inflation somewhat, but it would be a very inefficient way to do it. So I think we need to be cautious in looking forward. The distinction then also between what is transitory and what is permanent has to a considerable extent to do with how the inflation affects people's expectations. Do people think that prices are going to rise? And do they therefore buy now and buy more so as to beat the price increases? And do the financial markets raise interest rates? I don't see that those expectations have been excited to this point. And I am more in the camp of transitory inflation, but for the midterm elections next year, it would take a remarkable degree of change in a lot of areas, including how many truck drivers do we have to move all of those containers out of the ports? As just one example, that's not something that is going to change in time to affect people's attitudes in the midterm elections. I think that's baked in the cake.
I want to tell the audience that if anybody would like to ask a question for Joe or Diane, they can use the live chat function on YouTube and Facebook. And if you're using Twitter, use the hashtag BPC Live. Let me go back to the question of what the Fed might do in 2022. One of my Yahoo Finance colleagues today pointed out to me that it looks like the Fed is going to be in the position of raising interest rates for the first time in a in an election year and possibly close to the election, which could have a negative effect on financial markets. Who knows? Is that a problem for the Fed, Diane?
Well, the problem for the Fed is whether or not they're going to make the right decision. And I think what we're going to see, first of all, is the Fed left the door wide open to accelerate its tapering of asset purchases. That's the purchases of mortgage-backed securities and treasury bonds that it is trying to slow down the pace of right now, just easing up the foot a little bit on the gas pedal, not really hitting the brakes yet. And they left that door open in December. And I think we are going to see an acceleration of that tapering of asset purchases because they'd like to have some distance between the end of that tapering and liftoff in rates. I think we're going to see a liftoff in rates by mid-2022, part of it justified by a stronger economy and higher inflation. I also am a little bit more worried about the lingering effects of things like shelter costs and the more broadening of inflation that we're seeing out there through labor markets. We just have no precedence for understanding this. And I think it's really important to look at what has happened in terms of shelter costs. They're about a third of the CPI, mostly rents on everything from apartments to owner's equivalent rent. That's an imputed rent that you ask people, what would you rent your house for? Or what do you actually rent your house for? And both of those are going up and there's a tailwind on that. There's a lag in how we measure it. And that's going to keep underlying inflation elevated through 2022. Also talking to the energy producers out there, it looks like energy prices, although they won't go up as much as they've gone up this year, so that will slow the momentum in those prices. The levels are going to remain extremely high and could go up from where we are today. That is something also that consumers just hate, and there's not much the Fed can do about that. I agree with Joe. There's some parts of this inflation the Fed can't do anything about. The risk is the Fed is going to be sitting there in 2022 and looking at this and saying, how much of this is entrenched or not? And they're not going to know. And I think the real mistake actually is not raising rates in 2022. They will raise rates in 2022. The question is how rapidly and what do they signal about chasing inflation down? And I think that's really important because we've not had a Federal Reserve that moved to chase inflation at all since the early 1980s. They have been preempting a non-existent inflation for much of the last several decades. And so this is totally unique, the situation that we're in. And it's not that the Fed won't necessarily raise rates in an election year. It is that the Fed has to figure out what is the right policy and do they panic about where inflation is going and that they'll be wrong. And remember, the Fed is hardwired. Once we hit I think we'll hit full employment by mid part of 2022. I think momentum unemployment is very good. That's the good news. The downside is the Fed will have to decide at that point in time, is this really a different world than what they thought it was? And I think they're already getting that signal.
So let me just ask a more basic question about the economy overall. The economy is in pretty good shape by most standard metrics. And yet consumers are very gloomy. Just last week, we got, University of Michigan consumer confidence lowest in 11 years. The conference board's index is quite similar. Does this make sense? Is this just inflation or is there something else going on with consumers? Joe, I'll give that one to you.
Well, I think inflation is probably the proximate cause, and it's something that affects just about everybody. There are also the folks who lost jobs in the pandemic because of restrictions on activity, because of public health. Some of them have not found a way back yet, and that is a problem. Some of them can't go back because of issues like childcare, where, you know, we've talked about public schools reopening. For those who have children who are younger than that, childcare as a business is way down, in part because people had to go out of that business because of the stress and strains that occurred because of the pandemic. So there's that. There's inflation. I think beyond that, people are also worried about the fact that the pandemic is lingering on to some extent. You know, we talk about how we think it's going away. To some extent, in some parts of the country, it is. In other parts of the country, it's surging. And Europe, of course, is seeing now a substantial pickup in incidences of pandemic infection. So we don't really know where we're going. The weather's getting cooler. People are moving indoors, which is prime condition for the pandemic to get even worse. I think there are probably a lot of reasons for people who tend to be pessimistic right now. If you're looking for something to feed your pessimism, you don't have to look very far.
I wonder if we are, if there's any chance we are in the setup for a kind of a boom within 4, 6, 7 months. So let's look ahead to, let's say, April, May timeframe next year. We know we've got pent-up demand for automobiles, for appliances, for video game consoles. People want to spend the money. In many cases, they can't. By the time it starts to warm up next year, could we be seeing the boom that many people thought was going to be happening this time without the Delta variant? Diane, go ahead.
Oh, sure. You know, without the Delta variant, and then I think Joe made the absolute most important point is the course of the economy is dependent on the course of the virus. The Delta variant did set us back. It added to supply chain disruptions. It hit countries that evaded earlier waves of this pandemic, and we still are in a pandemic. So as much as we want it to be behind us, it's not yet. And until it is, we won't know the course of the economy fully. That said, we're on course, even with the supply shortages and the problems we face, to easily clear 5% in growth in 2021. As we get into 2022, we're also going to have another catch-up year on an annual basis, probably exceeding growth of 4% or coming close to it. That's important. That's still very, very robust growth compared to the subpar 2% growth we had for a decade or so of the last expansion. And that is the good news. The hard part of it is understanding what will be, as Joe pointed out, you know, will we see a surge in the virus that causes another pullback? Right now, reservations at OpenTable are 5% below what they were in 2019. And that's the best they've been pretty much since the entire pandemic. So we've got people going back indoors. And that's good, but it's also bad because if it causes a spread among the unvaccinated or those whose vaccines are waning, that's a problem. And we're seeing that in some parts of the country. Minnesota, Arizona are two places that are becoming hotspots and starting to see pressure on their healthcare systems already. I think the other important part here is to look at where are we going in terms of, you know, what's the tailwind? As Joe mentioned, the saving rate is really high, except for those who lost their jobs early on and lost support. Now, the child tax credit does help provide, we know it helped a lot of children who are hungry to get fed, which is fabulous, but that's about the only support left. We went off a cliff on unemployment insurance and supplements. Everyone thought that would bring people back into the labor force. It turned out the hurdles are much greater than that. The course of the virus still determines whether or not people can work or get the support they need to go back into the labor force, particularly for women. I think that's really important too. So I think we will be in a stronger place, but this fits and starts of the virus are really important. Also, people going to theaters surged in recent weeks. As we go into the holiday season, are we going to see some setback as we see people get sick again? And what does that mean for all the other knockoff effects? We know that it does slow the economy. The economy slowed to a crawl over the summer, a 2% rate, which would have been great before the crisis, but from above 6% in the first half of the year to nearly stalling out over the summer on consumer spending, even though we continue to create jobs. Yes, there's pent-up demand. Yes, we're going to unleash some of that. But I do think that we need to keep in mind we're still in a pandemic. And that is the biggest problem out there.
Joe, do you think we'll see a confidence recovery by next summer?
I don't want to sound like a broken record. I think Diane is right when she says that I'm right, that the pandemic is what's really behind all this. The question is, are we really going to feel confident going out and doing things in those sectors of the economy, like dining out, like many other areas of entertainment and retail, where there is some headroom in the economy? There is quite possibly a lot of available labor, but there isn't enough activity to make things happen. So I really want to see people start to behave as though they're taking this pandemic seriously, so that we have enough vaccination, not just in some parts of the country, but across the country, so that we can snuff this pandemic out. That's really, it seems to me, the prerequisite for a real improvement in confidence and a real rebound in this economy.
So we have an audience question asking about wages. Kayla, I believe is the name, writes and says, wages have not risen with inflation. Individuals are being more discerning about where and how to return to work. Please speak to pay equity. So I think wages have increased more than before the pandemic, but I believe they are not keeping up with inflation, which again was 6.2% in the latest reading. What do we know about incomes, Joe?
I'm not surprised that when you have a spike in inflation that it might take wages some time to pick up. To the extent that sellers believe that those increases in prices are going to be temporary and that those prices are going to fall back. So for example, looking at automobiles as a quintessential commodity here, new cars are in short supply because we don't have chips. Used cars are rising in prices astronomically because people want to buy cars and they can't buy new cars because there aren't any. Those prices we would expect in a market with the degree of competition that we had prior to the pandemic and that we almost certainly will have once the pandemic is dampened and we get those chips back, those prices are going to come down. They are, you know, particularly used cars. They are not just going to slow in their rate of inflation. So to that extent, if we're going to get relief on some prices, that is going to help people out in terms of pay. However, another phenomenon to observe here, and this of course is hard to measure, but it does appear as though a lot of the average increase in pay has occurred at the low end of the wage scale, because that's where you need to offer more to people to get them back to work. And there's been a lot of competition in that field. And you can see help wanted signs in a number of dining establishments and retail establishments and so forth. So it's a dynamic situation. I think we are going to get some relief on the price side. I do believe that there is going to be a reshuffling of pay, and that to some extent, we as a society are going to understand that we have to pay people who do work in fast food restaurants and so forth. They have to be compensated more. We're going to see where this comes out in the fullness of time. And I believe that at the end of the day, where we are going to be is going to be something that looks closer to what many of us would call pay equity. When the prices settle down, when wages go up at the low end of the scale, it's not going to be a big social movement, but I think that the forces are pushing us in that direction.
Diane, last question is for you. We started this program by talking with CBO Director Phil Swagel about the Build Back Better legislation. If that passes, let's call it a 50-50 proposition at this point, but if that passes by the end of the year, more or less as it looks right now, what impact is that likely to have on the economy? Will it add to inflation, for example?
I think there is a marginal component of it that will add to inflation. It also has important things in it that can help us ramp up to allow people to rejoin the labor force, which is really important. And to dovetail on one of Joe's last points about the wages accelerating at the low end of the scale, 1 million fewer people have multiple jobs today than they did in February 2020. That's not a bad thing. That's a good thing. And that's because wages at the low end have come up. It also is a testimony to how low wages were in the best of the last expansion for the lowest wage workers. That said, over a 2-year period in time, those wages have been eaten up by the commute costs of paying for higher gas, and they have to commute further because they no longer live where the jobs are. And that those are all frictions in the labor market that I think are really important. So in terms of, is the Build Back Better another inflationary impetus? Yes, it could be. It also is important to help bring workers back and to alleviate that those pressures over time. Workers that we need all hands on deck. We've lost, by our estimates, about 2 million immigrants since 2016. That accelerated from 2016 through 2019. We fell 40% on immigration, mostly legal immigration, and then accelerated during the pandemic. And that loss has really contributed to a loss in labor force growth as well. And immigrants who come here to work, of course, they have 100% participation rate. So that helps labor force participation as well. I think it's really important to look at all these factors when we're looking at the economy. Where wage gains, where job hoppers have gotten the best wage gains, it's those Generation Z, those young workers that are able to hop jobs with a very high education because we don't have enough of those people. That's where the labor shortages are the most acute, and they're getting huge premiums for hopping jobs. Those people at the low end of the scale, even though their wages went up, they don't get a big premium for hopping jobs. They're hopping jobs for flexibility, to be able to take care of their children, and for less hazards on the job, maybe getting somebody being violent with them because they ask them to put a mask on, those kinds of things. And they're even willing to sometimes take a little less, even though wages at the low end have come up.
All right. Diane Swonk of Grant Thornton, Joe Minarek of the Conference Board, thank you for spending some time with us here today.
Happy to.
We've got one more panel coming up as part of this program, and we're going to go back to Bill Hoagland at the Bipartisan Policy Center. Bill?
Thank you, Rick. Thank you, Joe. Thank you, Diane. Fascinating discussion. We're going to listen to two more economists now who have may have similar or may have different viewpoints. So let me introduce our two final panelists for today's discussion, Wendy Ellenberg and Brian Reel. Wendy is a director of the Hamilton Project and senior fellow in economic studies at the Brookings Institute. Most recently, she was a chief economist at the Congressional Budget Office and served under two administrations on the President's Council of Economic Advisors. Thank you for joining us, Wendy. And Brian is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. He served as as Senator Rob Portman's chief economist and was the director of the Senate Finance Subcommittee on Fiscal Responsibility and Economic Growth, and served for many years at the Heritage Foundation. Once again, I want to remind our viewers out there that if you have questions, to please submit your questions using the live chat function on your YouTube and Facebook, or via Twitter using hashtag BPCLive. We'll hopefully have some time for a few questions here before we conclude our afternoon here at 3 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. First, to both Brian and Wendy, just any reactions to what you've heard from the CBO director and from Diane or Joe to what they have to say? Anything, any responses, thoughts you have on what they put forth? Wendy?
So I have a couple. I don't want to go on too long, but one, I think Director Swagel made an excellent point that given the size of the debt, higher interest costs do have an outsized effect on interest payments, because you're applying an increase in interest rates to a much larger stock of debt, and that has a bigger effect on changing debt. But I want to be clear, higher interest rates over the next 10 years are not a risk to the projection. They're actually already in the projection. So CBO expects interest rates to double over the next 10 years. And even so, the debt as a share of GDP only rises quite modestly over the next 10 years. So rising interest rates should not be thought of as a cataclysmic risk. They're embedded in the baseline.
Thank you.
The other point that I want to make is just on a completely different topic of inflation and what we should be expecting about inflation and whether or not it's at all informative to think about whether inflation is temporary or permanent, transitory or persistent. The only reason why I find those distinctions useful is the question of whether we can point to particular factors that we are confident are underlying the increases in inflation and whether we can be confident that those factors are indeed temporary if we know what brought them about and we have a very good sense of where they're going to go in the future. And that is indeed the case when it comes to inflation. We have seen a massive surge in demand for consumer goods, completely unprecedented. The pivot in the composition of consumer spending away from services and towards goods is ahistorical. And so demand has risen far faster than supply could keep up, I think even outside of a pandemic. And then add on top of that, the supply constraints caused by a pandemic. And perhaps it's not so surprising. Of course, it's not surprising at all. And, you know, looking at it a little bit in hindsight, we've seen really significant inflation in the goods sector. We have not seen much inflation to talk about in the services sector because indeed that's where demand's been pretty soft. So the question is, what's happening now with inflation? Is there predictive power in it? Does it give us a signal for what's going to happen going forward? Well, of course, inflation expectations are critically important, well aware of that. But in terms of these factors I just talked about, the demand for goods is going to come down. It's already coming down, and as the pandemic recedes, it will come down further. And the supply constraints, to the extent that they're caused by the pandemic, will go away. And firms have every incentive in the world to try to get these products to market. So I don't think goods inflation is here to stay. That I just don't see how someone could look at the data and read that to be true. There are risks on the horizon. I'm aware of those risks, but I'm just not sure that what we're seeing provides a lot of information for what we're going to see going forward.
Thank you, Wendy. Brian, any thoughts on what you've heard from the participants so far?
Thanks, Bill. I would actually like to, because interest rates are a big topic right now, and they're the subject of a paper I have coming out. I'm actually very worried about interest rates colliding with our debt. It's correct. Right now, the federal government pays about a 1.7% interest rate on the federal debt, and CBO does project it'll rise over 3% over the next 10 years as an average interest rate paid on the debt. But the long-term trajectory for interest payments is still really staggering when you combine it with the fact that the debt is projected to go from $17 trillion to over $40 trillion between 2019 and 2031, which means by 2031, one percentage point interest rate would add about $400 billion a year in interest. Here's the scary number about interest. Based on just the CBO baseline interest rate projections, 30 years from now, we are going to have a debt of 200% of GDP in which interest will be the biggest part of the federal budget. And that's under modest interest rate assumptions. It'll be the most expensive part of the budget and it'll cost half of all tax revenues. Now, what if CBO is wrong? What if interest rates rise just one percentage point higher than their baseline over the next 30 years? That would add $30 trillion in interest costs over 30 years. By 2050, the debt would be 250% of GDP. Two-thirds of your taxes would go to paying interest on the debt, and the deficit would be 18% of GDP. That's just from one additional percentage point in interest rate above the CBO baseline, because the danger is when you have a baseline borrowing of $100 trillion over 30 years, even small changes in interest rates that happen gradually over 30 years can cost tens of trillions of dollars. So I'm really worried about interest rates, not necessarily today or tomorrow, but absolutely over the next 5, 10, 15 years.
Okay.
Can I jump in, Bill?
Go ahead, Wendy.
Absolutely agree that we have long-term challenges. Completely agree we have long-term challenges. And I would love to talk about how we could address our long-term fiscal challenges. But just one more minute on interest rates. So CBO does indeed project that interest rates will double over the next 10 years. They do not project that the average interest rate that the government pays to borrow will double over the next 10 years. So because debt rolls over very slowly, an increase in interest rates actually only affects a small portion of the debt in any particular year. So in fact, they project right now, I'm looking at these numbers over my shoulder, that the average interest rate on the debt is 1.7% in 2021, because they're actually, that includes some legacy debt that is being paid on with higher interest rates because they locked it in a couple of years ago when interest rates were a little higher. They actually project that the interest rate that the government pays to borrow, the average interest rate that it pays on its entire stock of debt, will fall to 1.5%, 1.4%, and then 1.5%, and then start modestly increasing over time. The other thing that I want to say is that interest rates being one percentage point higher than we project, which we should note, is like interest rates being 30% higher than we project. So one percentage point doesn't sound like a lot, but it's hugely different from where the projections are.
Thank you.
What I'd like to know is what caused that interest rate increase. One of the reasons why interest rates are quite low right now is because I think there's an expectation that we're going to grow quite slowly, that our economy is going to grow quite slowly over the next 30 years. If the reason that interest rates are higher, that real interest rates are higher, is because we are growing faster, we have stronger productivity growth, that also has to be taken into account because that has huge budgetary implications.
Thank you. I think we could continue to have this conversation. I want to shift gears just a little bit. I realize that this is Yahoo Finance, but I want to do a little shift a little gears to talk a little bit about politics. Given that the president will be signing the infrastructure bill here in just about 30 minutes, and given, Brian, that your old boss, Senator Portman, was instrumental in getting that out of the Senate in a bipartisan way, I'd like to kind of get your take on why it was that there was not more support in the House of Representatives or the final vote, more bipartisanship. And also, just while we're at it, we're talking a lot about debt and deficits here. It is my recollection is that the CBO scoring of the BIF bill, the bipartisan infrastructure bill, actually added to the deficit in the over the next 10 years of $200 billion. Why is it that the bipartisan infrastructure bill adding to the deficit doesn't matter while the Build Back Better has to be so paid for? What's the difference? Brian, any thoughts?
Sure. I think the CBO score, the infrastructure bill, is adding about $256 billion in deficits over 10 years. And really, that was an underestimate. There was a lot of gimmicks, even in that $256 billion. There was a big bailout to the Highway and Transit Trust Funds. You know, I think it's actually going to be an even bigger deficit than just that shortfall. I think both bills should have been paid for. I know I'm putting myself on different viewpoints than my former boss, Senator Portman. I think both bills should have been paid for. In fact, I would have preferred that we actually focused first on paying for our existing programs and shoring up existing deficits before we even thought of adding new spending. That being said, for the Senate GOP lawmakers that I spoke to, they said that the infrastructure bill was justified on three grounds compared to Build Back Better. They would tell you that it was a smaller cost and a smaller increase in deficit because Build Back Better, when you account for the extensions in the bill, will probably end up having a deficit of about $2.5 trillion over 10 years, according to the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. So they will say it was a smaller deficit increase. They will say that physical infrastructure is more of a GOP priority than social spending, that they assert will be better handled by state and local governments or the private sector. And third, politically, I think there probably are some Republicans in the Senate who are frustrated by the obstructionism charge and wanted to find something they could vote for to kind of lessen that. These factors weren't as persuasive with House Republicans. House Republicans come from more conservative districts than swing states. They're more conservative. They're more skeptical of this legislation. And rather than worrying about obstructionism charges, I think they're more concerned probably about throwing Democrats a life raft in the civil war we're seeing right now in the Democratic Party over those bills. So Democrats just kind of had a different outlook. Republicans had a little different outlook in the House than the Senate. But if it were up to me, both bills would have been paid for or perhaps not even happened at all, because I think we should focus on the existing deficit.
Thank you very much. And Wendy, I wish we had more time, but Wendy, let me come back to you on you testified recently before the Senate Joint Economic Committee, I believe. Today, November the 15th, is one of the last payments of the advanced child tax credit. I think the next payment's December 15th. At the end, unless this law is extended, that those child tax credits that are going, that have been going out there on a monthly basis will end. I guess next year there will be, you will be able to do the calculations on the basis of your tax filing, but those monthly payments are gone. Tell me, from your perspective, what's going to happen? I know you feel strongly, I think, that the social welfare programs really need to be addressed here, child care, earned income tax credit, paid family leave. What's your sense as to what's the future for these particular provisions that maybe people have become somewhat dependent upon?
So I can't speak so effectively to the political landscape here, but I can tell you that in terms of creating a more resilient economy and making sure that our economic growth is more widely shared, the improvements to the social insurance system that are in the Build Back Better Act are necessary. Making permanent the full refundability of the child tax credit is a no-brainer for reducing child poverty rates, which just has to be one of the highest priorities for any rich society. And furthermore, doing things like improving access to high-quality, affordable childcare, making sure that access to paid leave is not something that just a select few lucky workers get, but it is widely shared. The earned income tax credit has so many supporters on both sides of the aisle, and expanding that to childless adults is another no-brainer. There are so many parts of this bill that are just essential improvements to the social insurance system.
Good, thank you. I want to close out here. Rick asked, I thought, some insightful questions as it relates to our scoring of the tax gap, filling the tax gap. If I heard what the CBO director said, I'm not expecting that the final scoring, Phil was very careful about what he said, but I'm not expecting it to come out with $400 billion as the administration, Treasury, White House believes. In which case, if they came in even at $200 billion, that would mean that the bill technically is not paid for. What does that mean for a vote later this week or next week or sometime in December on Build Back Better? Brian and Wendy, go ahead. You've been there.
My guess is that it means far, far more than it should. I mean, let me say on this particular issue around the tax gap, this will not be news to anybody. Anybody who has been following how this legislation has been put together will know that CBO is going to come out with a lower number than what we've seen from Treasury, what we've seen from tax experts in this country. So this is not news. But it nonetheless will probably come to pass. And it may well be that what CBO says on the score, and maybe even what they say in the score, incorporating all of the footnotes and all of the tables, that they still want to get additional information, but things don't quite make it into the official score. It's quite possible that when all said and done, adding up all of the increases and all of the decreases to the deficit, that this modestly increases the deficit over the next 10 years. And because some policymakers, I think, have quite irresponsibly said that they won't vote for it unless it's fully paid for over a 10-year period, I think that will be a problem. The reason I think it's irresponsible is because policymakers, they focus on the wrong thing. This bill is important. It will do important things. It will make our economy, as I said, make our economy more resilient. It will improve people's lives, it will improve people's well-being. And the hyper-focus on a one-year, you know, on a 10-year number, I just think it's just the wrong focus.
Thank you. I know we're about to run out of time here. Brian, can you take 30 seconds and then I'll close it out here? Any last words?
These scores should matter because we're already facing more than $20 trillion in increased debt from 2019 to 2031. And even if CBO says it's $200 billion short because of the tax gap, come on, it's $2 trillion short because there's so many gimmicks in this bill. They're only scoring the first year of the child tax credit. They're only scoring the first 4 years of healthcare expansions. They're only scoring the first 6 years of family leave and some of the childcare. The White House has said the policy is for all these policies to be made permanent, but they're putting in expiration dates that everybody knows Congress is not going to hold to, which is actually going to make the bill $2 trillion in added deficits over 10 years. So as much as the tax gap might on paper shift it into deficit, forget on paper, reality tells us this bill is $2 trillion short.
Thank you. We could keep on going, but we have to close out here. I want to thank Yahoo Finance for their partnership in bringing this program together, and Rick Newman and his support and his interviews. We have to close out here. The signing ceremony at the White House will begin shortly. And for those of us who work for the Bipartisan Policy Center, at least we are pleased today that the legislation is defined as bipartisan. And here we go. Thank you very much. Thank you all for joining us this afternoon. Good day.